would have suffocated many times over, and my skin would be a permanent blue. He paused, seeing an email from Katie Pryor. What do you know? Look at this. He pointed at his screen. You see, Andre, I wouldn't ask you to do anything illegal. Now you sound like Vladimir Putin. Would that make you Donald Trump? Without the hair, obviously. Tracy laughed. You were able to get into the computer? Please, my grandson could get into the computer, and he's 3. Grandson? Vilkotsky had told Tracy that he and his wife married young and had children early. Tracy estimated him to be just late 40s. He pointed to a picture of his grandchild tacked on the inside of his cubicle wall. He spent the weekend at our house. My son and his wife are traveling. I'm still worn out. He reached behind him and grabbed Kavita Mukherjee's laptop along with a flash drive, onto which he'd transferred her emails. I programmed the computer so that a temporary password will open it. I did so before I received the warrant, so the password is, I didn't talk to you and know nothing about this. Tracy smiled. A little long, don't you think? Is that all caps? Vilkotsky smiled. Then the password is password 123. Each word starts with a cap. Clever. I don't have time to be clever. Thanks to your chief, I must now be available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, to help you people find stolen iPhones. Vilkotsky did not sound happy. I heard about that. Seattle Police Chief Sandy Claridge had issued the edict after a news report that thieves had stolen more than 2,000 cell phones during the first 6 months of the year. Yes, well, now it doesn't make me sleep too good. Tracy grabbed the laptop. I appreciate the help, Andre. Yeah, yeah, he said. Tracy could have had Vilkotsky email her the download or have Katie Pryor pick up the computer, but she had a different question she hoped he could help her with. Andre, can you track a cell phone?
I don't understand.
She gestured to the laptop. This woman who went missing, I want to track her cell phone. Could I do that?
Why don't you just call the service provider and get the longitude and latitude?
Yeah, I understand Katie Pryor did that this morning. Not wanting to leave a paper trail that she was pursuing the case, Tracy had everything sent through Pryor. I'm just wondering if there is some other way to track her phone, if it's still turned on, without using the stingray. Vilkotsky feigned shock. Wide-eyed, he said,
Stingray? What stingray?
The Stingray was a simulated cell phone tower police set up to surreptitiously gather information from suspects' phones, as well as to monitor any other mobile device in the area. Most police departments denied having the machine, which was developed for the FBI and provided to local law enforcement only after the department signed a non-disclosure agreement to not discuss the technology. Recent news stories reported that the Tacoma Police Department had used the machine, and ACLU lawyers quickly got worked up. In eternally liberal Seattle, it was better for a thief to commit a crime than to have his privacy invaded. Is there another way? Tracy asked. Vilkotsky gave this a moment of thought. Then he said,
There are always other ways. For instance, there are certain apps that can be shared.
Such as?
For one, did the woman have a Find My Friends app on her phone?
I don't know, Tracy said.
If she did, you might be able to track her phone from a friend's phone.
Tracy thought of Aditi. It was worth a try. She made a mental note. Okay. Any other apps?
Many phones have Find My iPhone, but you would need her Apple ID and password.
How might I get that? Again, she thought of Aditi as a potential source.
I would check her computer. Some people put that information under context so they don't forget. It is sort of a master key. I do that myself.
Tracy made another mental note to check the laptop.
Was your woman living with family?
Vilkotsky asked. No. Why? He shrugged.
Families often use one Apple ID so they can share music, movies, and books without having to purchase it multiple times. I do this also.
And you can share this across multiple phones?
Multiple phones and platforms like laptops, iPads, computers.
Tracy gave that some thought.
What about friends? Can they share an Apple ID?
You said this woman is a college student.
Recent graduate. Vilkotsky rolled his eyes.
College students never pay for anything if they can find a way to get it for free. And they usually can. They would have made great Bolsheviks.
Tracy walked Kavita Mukherjee's computer and the flash drive over to Katie Pryor, the missing persons unit. You get anything from the service provider yet? She asked. I just sent in the exigent circumstances request form, Pryor said. She nodded to the computer. You got the flash drive? Tracy handed it to her. Pryor inserted the drive and pulled up Kavita Mukherjee's emails, those received and those sent. She and Tracy immediately focused on emails Mukherjee had received after 5 p.m. Monday afternoon. Mukherjee had not responded to any of them. They did not find any emails pertaining to her date, Monday night, nor did they find an email confirming a hotel or airline reservation. Tracy booted up the computer and used the temporary password Vilkotsky had provided to review Mukherjee's internet history, looking through her searches for airlines, rental car companies, websites related to other states and foreign countries. She found nothing.
Let's go to her contacts, Tracy said.
What are we looking for? Pryor asked. Vilkotsky said people sometimes keep their passwords in a master file under a contact. Let's see if she did. In contacts, Pryor searched the name Mukherjee and pulled up Mukherjee's parents and her two brothers. The others Tracy did not recognize, but deduced to be relatives. She's not there, Pryor said, meaning no contact information for Kavita. Tracy thought of her conversations with Aditi Banerjee and with Mukherjee's family. Type in Vita. Pryor did, and she got a hit for someone named Vita Kumari. Who is that? She asked.
Don't know, Tracy said.
Pryor opened the contact and scrolled to the notes section. The contact included frequent flyer account numbers, bank account numbers, login names, and passwords. The list was in alphabetical order, and Pryor noted a bank account for the Bank of America. Hang on. She flipped through documents on her desk and confirmed the number to be the Bank of America account number Mukherjee's parents had provided. That's her bank account, she said. She's using a fake name, Tracy said, thinking Mukherjee did so in case the computer was ever stolen. Then those are her usernames and passwords, Pryor said. Pull up the Bank of America account and try the username and password. Within minutes, Pryor was on the website. Mukherjee's login information worked. The account did not show any transactions after Saturday afternoon. The last transaction had been a withdrawal of $20 from an ATM on University Avenue the previous Thursday, leaving Mukherjee a balance of $1,492. She'd have trouble paying next month's rent. Why would she tear up Aditi's rent check? Pryor asked. I mean, did she have so much pride she would reject help? It's possible, Tracy said. Aditi said she was stubborn, or she could have already made up her mind to either move or to get another roommate. Pryor continued to scroll through the notes for the contact Vita Kumari. Near the bottom of the list, Tracy said, Stop. What is that? Is that another bank account? Wells Fargo, Pryor said. Sure looks like another account. Try it, Tracy said. Pryor pulled up the website for Wells Fargo and entered the corresponding username and password. It took a second to load before they gained access to the account. Tracy whistled. She and Pryor were staring at an account with a balance of $29,230. Maybe this is why she tore up the check, Pryor said. Tracy sat back, stumped. Aditi said she was saving for medical school, but I'm having a hard time believing she saved this much working in a clothing store at minimum wage. Her parents? Pryor said. Not if they were intent on her moving home, Tracy said. Look at the name on the account, Vita Kumari, and the address is a P.O. box, Tracy said. She clearly did not want anyone to know about this account. Tracy ran her hand down one of the columns of numbers. Each deposited amount was identical. Those are direct deposits. The same amount deposited on the same day every month, Pryor said. We can use the routing number to find out who's making the payment, but I'm going to need a search warrant for the bank to get it. Tracy thought of Aditi, specifically the way the young woman had looked to her husband, as if embarrassed when Tracy asked her questions about Kavita. "You feel like taking a drive?" she said. "I might know a way to get a faster answer." 24. Andrea Gonzalez told Foz that the name Eduardo Felix Lopez had produced a hit for a 19-year-old male arrested just 2 months earlier for possession of a controlled substance, meth. He had provided an apartment in a multi-story brick complex in South Park as his home address. That was both good news and bad news. With the address being 2 months old, Lopez could have moved, or maybe even fled to Mexico, if he was their shooter. There was no phone number associated with the address, nor could they locate a building superintendent to ask whether Lopez remained a tenant. Lopez had several other priors, each for possession, and one for intent to distribute, but no arrests for a violent crime. Nothing in the system indicated Lopez was a member of the Sereños, but if he was dealing drugs in South Park, that seemed a given. Perhaps Monique Rogers's husband had been correct, and his wife's shooting had been a prerequisite to Lopez's gang initiation. Foz decided to treat the interview as non-custodial, at least until they determined whether the address was still good. If it was, and if Lopez was home, they'd ask to search his apartment. If he refused, they'd seek a search warrant for the apartment, specifically seeking the .40-caliber revolver that had killed Rogers, then sit on Lopez until they had it. As Foz and Andrea Gonzalez drove out of the police parking structure, she looked up through the windshield at roiling dark clouds to the northeast. "What's going on with the weather? It looks like a biblical plague," she said. "Thunderstorms," Foz said. "I thought we weren't supposed to get thunderstorms west of the Rocky Mountains. Earthquakes are what I was told to worry about." Foz cut down Columbia Street to the on-ramp to the Alaskan Way Viaduct. "We get one or two thunderstorms a year in the Northwest. We got one last year about this same time of year. It caused fires all over eastern Washington." Foz took the viaduct south. From their perch above the surface streets, he could see whitecaps, stirred by the wind, picking up on Puget Sound. "I watched the storm last year from a ringside seat at police headquarters working the night shift. The Space Needle lit up like something out of a science fiction novel." Gonzalez gave a small chuckle. "And here I thought I'd found nirvana. 80 degrees, no rain, clear skies. Felt like L.A. without the smog, the crowds, and the traffic, and still about 20 degrees cooler." Gonzalez looked again at the sky before sitting back. "You think Lopez is our guy?" "The timing and the location are right. He could have heard the shooting and run for cover." "He could have, but then why the hoodie over his face?" Gonzalez gave that some thought. "You think he's still around?" "If he was working for Little Jimmy, following orders, it's possible he got sent to L.A. or to Mexico. We're going to find out." "And if he's home, what do we say? How do we justify knocking on his door?" "If he's home, we'll say we're canvassing the area, asking if anyone saw or knows anything about the shooting. We'll ask to search his apartment. Most of these guys don't know any better and let us in. If he refuses, we'll call in a search warrant and keep an eye on him until we get it signed." "You think he'll run? If he was acting on Little Jimmy's orders, and they find out we're onto him, he won't have a choice. Little Jimmy will kill him." Tracy called Aditi on the pretense that she wanted to provide an update on the search for Kavita. Aditi and her new husband had temporarily moved into her parents' home, which was less than a mile from the Mukherjee family home. Tracy needed to talk with Aditi in private, away from Rashesh and the rest of her family. She sensed Aditi was holding something back, something about Kavita that she would not discuss in their presence, something that might explain the $30,000 sitting in a bank account under the name Vita Kumari. On the drive to Bellevue, Pryor received an email from the cell phone provider with the last known longitude and latitude of Kavita Mukherjee's telephone. 47.652770 latitude and 122.174406 longitude. "It's a state park," she said, pulling up the coordinates. "And it's very close to both homes." Pryor showed the phone to Tracy, who felt a pit in her stomach when she saw a heavily wooded area. Pryor's further research revealed the park to be nearly 500 acres, an ideal place to hide a body. However, Pryor's further research also revealed the park to be heavily trafficked, particularly in the summer, with joggers, walkers, berry pickers, and horseback riders. Odd, then, that no one would find a body. Tracy checked her watch. They had just a couple hours of daylight. "Call the canine unit," she said. "Ask if they can stand by in case we need them. We'll go after we speak to Aditi." Aditi answered the door of her parents' home, and for a brief moment, Tracy thought they'd caught a break, and the young woman stood alone. But as the door pitched farther in, Rishesh appeared behind it. Rishesh invited them into the living room, which looked to be more for show than use. Beige walls, gray furniture, brown carpet. A decorative piece of spiraling copper hung on the wall. It took Tracy a second to realize the image was a peacock. Two plastic plants adorned each side of a bay window, through which Tracy could see an expansive backyard, and behind it, a thick grove of trees. "Is that the state park?" Tracy asked, pointing out the window. "Yes," Aditi said. "Bridal trails." "Does Kavita's parents' home also butt up against the park?"
"Not exactly, but it's very close," Aditi said.
Tracy glanced at Pryor, who nodded and said, "Are your parents home?"
"No," Aditi said. "They're out."
"We spoke with Kavita's family and a couple of her co-workers yesterday afternoon. I wonder if you can answer a few additional questions," Pryor said.
"I can try," Aditi adjusted in her seat.
"What type of relationship did Kavita have with her two brothers?" Tracy asked. Aditi shrugged.
"There has always been a sibling rivalry between Vita and Nikhil because they're so close in age."
Tracy noted Aditi's use of the name Vita. "He seems to have pretty strong opinions about his sister's refusing to move home or submit to an arranged marriage." Aditi appeared to cringe at Tracy's use of the word submit.
"Nikhil is very traditional. He believes it is a waste of his parents' money to send Vita to medical school. He believes that is a decision for her future husband to make."
Aditi smiled at Rishesh, though it looked forced. Tracy said, "Why would he care if the parents weren't going to pay for it?"
"He considers her actions disrespectful and an embarrassment to the family," Aditi said. "It is just Nikhil's way as the oldest son. He has always been more traditional than Vita."
"And what about Sam?"
Aditi smiled. "Sam is more like Vita."
"How did Kavita plan to pay for medical school without her parents' help?" Tracy asked.
"She was working and saving money," Aditi said.
"At the store?"
"Correct."
"Anywhere else?"
Aditi shook her head. "Not that I know of. She could have gotten another job while I was away, but..."
"But she didn't say that, did she?" Tracy asked.
"No."
"And she was receiving minimum wage at the clothing store?"
"I believe so."
"So how could she save for medical school?" Tracy asked. "Even with you living there?" Aditi paused before answering.
"We had talked about applying for financial aid and student loans. Living on our own, not declaring our parents' income, Vita was confident we would receive assistance."
"How much had she saved?" Tracy asked.
"I don't know," Aditi said.
"Did she inherit any money from anyone? A grandparent, perhaps?"
"I don't believe so," Aditi said.
She shifted, looking uncomfortable with the topic. "I wonder if I could get a drink of water," Pryor asked, as planned. She turned to Rishesh. "Would you mind?" Rishesh looked puzzled by the request.
"I'll get it," Aditi started to stand.
"No, you stay here with Detective Crosswhite," Pryor said, trying to keep her tone casual but forceful. "Her questions are directed at you. Would you mind, Rishesh?" Rishesh, looking somewhat flummoxed, stood and led Pryor out of the room. Tracy kept her gaze on Aditi, who watched until Pryor and Rishesh had left the room. Then she said, "We can't help if you're not honest with us, Aditi." Aditi tried to look surprised.
"I don't know what..."
"We obtained Kavita's bank records. She has a Wells Fargo account under the name Vita Kumari. It has close to $30,000 in it. She watched for Aditi's reaction. The amount seemed to surprise her, but not the fact that Vita had another account. A payment of $2,000 is being deposited into the account on the first day of each month. We can trace the routing number, but I think you know where that money is coming from. Aditi looked stricken.
Rashesh cannot know, she said, her voice rushed and almost pleading.
We don't have to tell him anything, Tracy said. But we need to know.
I can get away later to speak with you.
Aditi turned when Katie Pryor and Rashesh re-entered the room. She sat back with a forced smile and pleading eyes. Tracy was tempted to push her, to tell her they couldn't afford to waste any time, that the longer a person was missing, the less likely they would be found alive. But she decided to respect Aditi's request, pursue other lines of inquiry, and go to the park to search for the phone while it remained light out. Sam said Vita told you she had a date Monday night. Did she mention a date to you?
No, Aditi said. I did not know.
Tracy looked at the window. You're familiar with the state park?
Bridal Trails, Aditi said.
Yes. Does it have any significance to you and Kavita?
We spent a lot of time in that park when we were young, Aditi said. We used to run the trails and occasionally we'd ride horses. Our families picked blackberries and hunted for chanterelle mushrooms. Why do you ask?
Was there any place in particular where you and Kavita would go inside the park?
I don't understand.
Did you have a favorite spot, a place you might meet?
No, no place in particular.
Tracy recalled what Andrei Vilkotsky had told her and asked, Did you and Kavita share any apps on your phones? Aditi continued to look puzzled by the line of questioning.
I don't think so.
Did you have an app on your phone called Find My Friends? She shook her head.
Do you want me to check?
Yes, I do. Aditi stood, left the room, and returned with her phone, scrolling through the apps.
No, I don't have that one.
What about Find My iPhone? Do you own that app? Tracy asked.
That one I have. Aditi said. Here.
She held up the phone for Tracy and Pryor to see. And what about Kavita? Did she also have that app?
I believe it comes with the phone, doesn't it?
She looked to Rashesh, but he shook his head.
I don't know, Tracy said.
Did you and Kavita share an Apple account, you know, to download music and movies, books?
Aditi looked up at Tracy, about to speak.
Then she paused. And in her suddenly widening eyes, Tracy could see that the young woman had figured out Tracy's line of questioning, and maybe, just maybe, a way for them to find Kavita Mukherjee's phone. Kavita had kept up a happy persona, a perky smile on her face, her emotions carefully tucked away, this one last time. When the date and the relationship ended, she left the hotel room feeling the gravity of her day. It felt like too much for her to bear alone, too much for her to handle. She did not want to go back to an empty apartment to sit alone, wondering what the hell had happened in the course of 3 months. She had always told herself that it was not her dream she was pursuing. It had been their dream, hers and Aditi's. No longer. Aditi was married. She would not be attending medical school. As Kavita drove from the hotel, the sun had begun to set, and the weather had cooled to a comfortable temperature. She drove out of the hotel parking lot without ever looking back, and thought that to be a good metaphor for how she would now get through life. She would not look back. There was no time to look back. She had made the decision to share her money with Aditi willingly, and without any regret, because she knew it had been hard for Aditi to stomach how easy things seemed to be for Vita, though Aditi had never expressed any resentment or jealousy, until Monday night. Maybe Kavita should have known. Throughout their lives, Aditi had always been there for Vita, and she had looked upon this as an opportunity to be there for Aditi, to not leave Aditi behind. Wherever Kavita went, to whatever school, she had decided she would not leave Aditi behind. That had been the plan, anyway. Kavita sighed. She wondered if things would have been different if she had told Aditi about the money, if it would have made Aditi rethink Rashesh's proposal. Maybe it would have made the dream of medical school that much closer to a reality, something she could have clung to when her parents had pressured her to marry. Maybe. But Kavita would never know. Not now. And she couldn't stop and look back. She had to look ahead. Had to, or she'd go crazy. The car in front of her braked suddenly. Instinctively, her foot slid from the gas pedal, and she slammed hard on the brakes, tires squealing, her body thrown forward against the shoulder strap. The driver behind her also hit his brakes and his horn. Thankfully, Kavita had not plowed into the car in front of her, or been rear-ended. She pulled to the side of the road. She needed a moment to catch her breath and regroup. She'd been driving on autopilot, and now that she'd stopped, she realized she'd driven in the direction she had driven for so many years, to her parents' home in Bellevue, not to Seattle. She wondered if there was something in her subconscious, something pulling her home. A part of her wanted to go, now more than ever. A part of her wanted to see her family. But she knew she couldn't go home, not like this, not this emotionally vulnerable, depressed, and defeated. Her mother would seize this opportunity to toss Aditi's marriage in her face, as Mrs. Dasgupta no doubt had done, building up her new son-in-law's family and apparent wealth, relishing the thought of Aditi living in a London condominium, not to mention all of her impending grandchildren. It must have been painful for Kavita's mother, though not as painful as it was for Kavita. Kavita's pain was born of the loss of someone she loved dearly. Her mother's pain was born of anger and resentment. The two were not the same. No, Kavita's mother would not console her. She'd lament again about how selfishly Kavita was behaving. She would guilt-trip Kavita for not giving her a son-in-law or grandchildren, and for making her and Praniv look bad to the family's friends. Her father would largely remain silent, not wanting to upset his wife. And Nikhil would start again about tradition and heritage and culture. Only Sam would be happy to see her. Sam. Kavita considered her phone. Sam had sent her a text message earlier, knowing that the news of Aditi's marriage would be upsetting. He had invited her to his soccer game near the university, but she couldn't go. She'd missed his game, missed the chance to see him. In the distance, she saw the tops of the 200-foot trees marking the state park, and her memories made her smile. She recalled the games she and Aditi and her brothers had played as children in those woods, and of her family's summer outings picking blackberries to make jam, and hunting for chanterelle mushrooms. She had gone into the park nearly every day as a child. It was like having a 500-acre backyard, and as she grew older, the park had also become Kavita's refuge. A place where she could go when everything had gone wrong. She'd walk among the trees or sit in a quiet place to contemplate and seek answers. She pulled away from the curb. She wouldn't go home. She didn't need to. She'd go to the park. 25. Foz turned into the parking lot of the Ridge Apartments, a multi-story building at the end of South Cloverdale, which became First Avenue South, just past State Route 99. "Let's see if anyone is home," he said. In the passenger seat, Andrea Gonzalez was checking her cell phone. She slid it inside her suit coat and said, "You sure you don't want to just scope it out? Let SWAT come in and serve a warrant?" Foz glanced over at her. According to Nolasco, Gonzalez had a lot of experience in a tough city, but she was clearly rethinking a non-custodial interview. "You getting cold feet?" She scowled. "Please, I did this a number of times in L.A. I just know from experience that you can prepare for anything and still get it wrong. Times like this, it's nice to have a guy at your back with armor and an AR-15 ready to put a round up somebody's ass." "Maybe so, but this isn't L.A., and we're already in the middle of a Justice Department investigation into the use of excessive force. We call in SWAT when it isn't needed, and we might have somebody else at our back ready to put a foot up our ass." He considered the building. "Look, most of these people are poor, not criminals. They're trying to live their lives just like you and me, and they don't like guys like Little Jimmy any more than we do. but they have to tolerate him if they're going to live here. Gonzalez tilted her head. The real question is, how will they tolerate us? Foz shrugged. Don't expect them to roll out the red carpet or offer you a cold drink, but they'll largely stay out of our way. And chances are, if Lopez is even still here, he'll tell us he didn't see or hear anything, and if he refuses to let us look around, we'll thank him and leave. Once we know he still lives here, we'll get a search warrant. Foz pushed open the car door and stepped out into a gusting wind. The dark clouds that had hovered on the eastern horizon now filled the sky, coloring it a darkening gray. Gonzalez came around the back of the car, raising her voice to be heard above the rush of wind. If locusts start falling from the sky, you're on your own. At the building entrance, Gonzalez pulled the door handle without a pause, and the door opened, despite a black box mounted on the wall indicating the door was supposed to lock by a security latch. Saw this a lot in L.A., she said as they stepped inside. The residents lose their keys so often, the supervisor gets tired of being called at all hours of the day and night to open the door. They just disengage the automatic lock. The interior lobby was austere, as in empty. Not a chair, sofa, or potted plant to be found on the well-worn tile. Small interior mailboxes lined the far wall, some open, others missing doors altogether. Those with doors had slots for the name of the tenant, but all were blank. "Saw this also," Gonzalez said. "The tenants protect their anonymity. The less you know about anyone else, the less they know about you." Gonzalez hit the elevator call button as a stairwell door to their right flung open, and a Hispanic man stepped into the lobby, moving quickly. He eyed them, but kept walking, pushing out the front door and looking back over his shoulder with a practiced, hardened stare. The elevator pinged and the doors pulled apart. Gonzalez took a step inside and quickly retreated, a horrified look on her face. Foz didn't have to ask why. The pungent odor of urine swept over him like a wave of toxic gas. When she could speak, Gonzalez said, "Let's take the stairs."
"Five flights? I don't think so."
Foz removed a handkerchief from his pocket, covered his mouth and nose, and stepped inside. Chivalry would have to take a back seat to self-preservation.
"You coming?"
Gonzalez took a deep breath and pulled her jacket over her nose and mouth, grimacing as if fighting a massive headache or the urge to puke. Not surprisingly, the elevator didn't stop to pick up any passengers as it ascended.
"Now we know why that guy took the stairs," Foz said, voice muffled by the handkerchief.
When the doors pulled apart, they hurried off onto the fifth floor, gasping as if they'd been holding their breath. Foz took a moment to assess their situation. They stood at the south end of the building, the cracked linoleum lit by the fading ambient light through windows at each end of the hallway. The deepening gray should have been more than enough to trigger the light sensors, but none were on.
"They steeled the light bulbs."
Gonzalez pointed at a light fixture missing both bulbs, just two bare sockets where the lights should have been.
"The landlord finally gives up buying new bulbs." "Saw a lot of that in L.A. too?" Foz asked.
The hallway smelled of mildew, the walls scarred and nicked. Lopez lived in apartment 511, which they determined to be the last apartment at the other end of the hall. As they approached, a blue-white flash sparked. Seconds later, thunder detonated, rattling the aluminum-framed windows.
"Told ya," Foz said. "Thunderstorms in July."
"Without the rain? That's just crazy," Gonzalez said.
"Oh, you'll get plenty of rain. That starts in a couple of months. Still think this place is nirvana?"
As they neared apartment 511, they stopped talking and took up positions on either side of the apartment door. Foz faced the southern window. Gonzalez faced the long hall they'd just walked. He gave her a slight nod, and she reached to knock on Lopez's apartment door. But just as quickly, Foz grabbed her arm and raised a finger to his lips. He thought he'd heard a faint voice through the paper-thin walls. They both listened. Foz heard the voice again, and this time Gonzalez nodded. She'd also heard it. It was a male, speaking Spanish. Gonzalez mouthed the word. Spanish.
Foz looked at the door to apartment 511, then looked over his shoulder at the door to the adjacent apartment, 509. He pointed to door 509 and said softly, "This one?" Gonzalez shrugged. "Can't tell," she whispered. Foz unclipped his gun and rested his hand on the grip. Gonzalez did the same. The walls, thin enough to transmit soft whispers, weren't about to stop bullets if someone started shooting. But there was nowhere to take cover in the cramped hall. Gonzalez raised her fist to knock. Foz heard the voice again, this time definitely coming from the adjacent door. At that same moment, he heard the door pull open. Gonzalez's eyes shifted to a spot over Foz's left shoulder, then widened in surprise or fear. She stepped toward him as she unholstered and raised her weapon, shoving him off balance. "Gun!" When Aditi typed in the Apple username and password she and Kavita had shared, the Find My iPhone app produced a blinking blue dot in the southwest corner of the state park. It was roughly in the same location as the last known longitude and latitude pinpointed by the service provider. Tracy and Pryor thanked Aditi and quickly left, telling her they would let her know what, if anything, they found. As Tracy drove the exterior of the park, taking in its immenseness while trying to find access, her sense of foreboding deepened. "You'd think somebody would have found a body, wouldn't you?" Pryor asked in a quiet voice. "With as much foot traffic as this park gets?" Tracy did, but she didn't say it. They had not discussed the ramifications of the blue dot well inside the Dasgupta home. They both knew what blinking blue light meant. Either Mukherjee's phone had been discarded in the park, or she had. Kavita drove with a new sense of purpose. Move forward. Do not stagnate. Have a plan. Execute it. She turned into the parking lot, which was empty but for one other car, likely a runner using the trails. She stepped from her car to the familiar smell of trees and plants, and it transported her back to a simpler time, when everything she had needed—family, friends, and school—was located right here, in this neighborhood. She moved quickly to the trailhead, but stopped and considered her flats, which she'd worn to avoid accentuating her height during her date. She had not brought another pair of shoes, as she had not planned to come to the park. Undeterred, she started up the slope. The sun had dipped below the canopy of trees, filtering through the branches in wedges and shafts of soft light. Kavita had walked the park's trail so many times, she knew the trail signs so well, she could find her way blindfolded. After several hundred yards, the trail forked, and Kavita took the Trillium Trail, a 1.7-mile loop that circled the interior of the park. Within minutes of breathing in the park's familiar odors, she felt better. She contemplated her dilemma and, more important, how to resolve it. First, she had to determine whether or not to stay in the apartment, at least until she left for medical school. She didn't want Aditi's charity any more than Aditi wanted hers. Now that Aditi had made her choice, Kavita could use a portion of the money she'd earned to pay the rent until she found a new roommate, a graduate student, she decided. It might be difficult to find a roommate in the summer, but in the fall, when the students returned, the apartment would be in high demand for its proximity to the campus. Problem solved. Next, Kavita would pick up additional hours working at the clothing store so as not to dip too far into her nest egg. The owner liked her. He would give her an additional shift. Being at work more would also help her ward off loneliness, especially at night, when she and Aditi had hung out. To this end, Kavita decided she would also enroll in a night course to study for her MCAT, the medical college application test. Presuming she did well on the test, she'd apply to a select number of medical school programs for admittance the following fall. Schools where everything was new and no one knew her. She would start fresh, away from her family, away from everything. The thought was, at the same time, liberating and terrifying. She would be leaving everything she had ever known, everyone she had loved. She got choked up at the thought of leaving her little brother, Sam, and her father. It would feel like a death, not seeing them. Her sobs came in a rush, unexpected and powerful. She stopped beneath the branches, weeping. After several minutes, she chastised herself and went back to her new mantra. Move forward. She needed to move forward. She dropped her head and ran, feeling every pebble in the path through the soles of her flats. When she came to where the trail split again, she took the coyote trail, running deeper into the park. She pushed herself through her sorrow until fatigue set in and she had to stop and catch her breath. She walked in circles, her head thrown back, her lungs and chest aching, sucking in air. The daylight had nearly extinguished, the forest now an ever-deepening gray. It was time to go home. Something moved. She turned. Something in the brush. She turned again. Then a third time. Something circling her. She turned yet again, but saw only the trees, straight and tall, like darkened sentries. She fought to hold her breath, struggling to listen. The crickets clicked and the unseen insects buzzed. A light breeze caught the limbs of the trees, causing them to moan and creak. A bullfrog croaked. She took another deep breath, exhaled, and turned to leave. The weather quickly worsened. Dark clouds had rolled over the Cascade Mountain Range and pushed west toward Seattle. It had all the makings of a violent thunderstorm. Could just be her phone, Pryor said again, sounding nervous as Tracy turned onto 116th Avenue Northeast. She could have lost it, or gotten rid of it. Maybe, Tracy thought, though it didn't answer a more fundamental question. What was Kavita doing this close to home in a state park that clearly had some sentimental value? Tracy couldn't help but wonder if the young woman, overwrought with sadness, had come to a place she knew and had taken her own life. But even as that thought entered her mind, Tracy dismissed it as contrary to the determined young woman Aditi had described. You don't think so, do you? Pryor asked. You don't think it could just be her phone? I'm trying to remain optimistic, but... No, I don't think so. Tracy could no longer ignore reason and common sense for something so fleeting as hope. There doesn't seem to be a good reason she'd discard it, not in a park. If it's just a phone, it's more likely someone else discarded it, and that still leaves questions like, why, and where is she? Tracy slowed at brown signs designating the park entrance. One bore the image of a hiker with a walking staff, the other a cowboy on horseback. She drove into a parking lot and parked beside three cars facing towering trees and thick brush. When she shut off the engine and pushed out into a stiffening breeze, she heard the rush and hum of cars on the 405 freeway, 100 yards to the west. "Let's photograph the license plates of the parked cars," she said. "I doubt it matters, but let's do it anyway. We can run them later." Pryor took the photographs as Tracy retrieved the go bag she used to process crime scenes and kept in the storage space behind her seat. She pulled out an SPD hat and threaded her hair through the opening. Then she slipped on a black windbreaker with the same white SPD initials across the back. She removed a flashlight, directed the beam of light at the ground, and handed it to Pryor when she came around the bed of the truck. A gust of wind rattled the tree branches, causing them to shimmer and shake. "You remember the lightning storm last July?" Pryor asked. "Hard to forget. Let's go before it's on top of us and we lose what little daylight we have left." Pryor considered her phone. "The signal is due east." They took a well-defined dirt trail, climbing a slope for the first 100 yards. Horse droppings and tiny acorns littered the ground. At the top of the slope, the trail flattened and forked. A stake in the ground indicated it was the trailhead for two different paths. Tracy stopped, and Pryor checked the phone again. The Trillium Trail, perhaps 6 feet wide, proceeded more or less straight, which was also the general direction of the flashing blue dot. "This way." As Tracy and Pryor followed the trail, the forest canopy grew thicker, and what ambient light existed faded to shadows. Tracy's father had taught her and Sarah about forests when she and her sister were growing up in a town in the North Cascades. She recognized the heftiest trees to be second-growth western red cedar, perhaps 100 years old and 200 feet high. The gaps were filled in by smaller hemlock, Douglas fir, and a few maple and cottonwood trees. The ground cover was dense and consisted of rotting tree trunks, ferns, salal, red elderberry, Indian plum, and low Oregon grape bushes. Though it hadn't rained, the park smelled damp from the abundant ferns. The wind howled, sometimes in gusts, that caused the tree trunks to sway and the branches to creak and moan. After several hundred yards, the trail again forked. The coyote trail continued to the left, in the direction of the flashing blue light on the phone. They walked on. The first chorus of thunder struck, a distant thrum to the east. Tracy briefly contemplated going back to the parking lot, waiting out the storm and calling for a canine unit, but instead she pushed forward. Seconds later, the forest sparked, a dazzling flash of light that caused the air to crackle just before thunder detonated. It sounded like the blast of a shotgun. The storm was moving fast. "That felt close," Tracy said over the echoing retort. "Too close," Pryor said, glancing up. The blue signal on the phone continued flashing. "We're almost there, come on." Tracy left the main trail for less defined foot trails and climbed another incline, came down the slope, and crossed a footbridge. The trail looped to the south. Between the trees, along the southernmost edge of the park, Tracy could see pitched roofs. She stopped to again consider the blue dot. "That direction," Pryor said, pointing. "There's a path," Tracy said, using the beam of her flashlight to highlight an unmarked trail snaking through the underbrush. Lightning struck again, this time a brilliant spark that lit the area in shades of blue and gray and rippled the air. Almost immediately, thunder exploded, this time loud enough to cause Tracy and Pryor to instinctively duck. "Shit," Pryor said. Tracy thought again about turning back, but the blue dot beckoned, ever closer, as did the thought that Mukherjee's phone could be low on power and might soon die. Still, she also knew Pryor had kids at home. "Why don't you go back to the parking lot?" she said. "I can finish this and we'll meet there." "No," Pryor said, shaking her head, determined. "Let's go. We're almost there." "Try to stay off the path," Tracy said. "Walk in the underbrush." If there were shoe prints in the path, Tracy knew they could be important. They slowed their pace, picking each step carefully, shining the light on the bushes and looking for colors that didn't belong. They were walking toward the houses along the park perimeter. Tracy stopped. According to the app, they were directly on top of the flashing blue light. "It's here somewhere," she said. They swept their flashlights over the underbrush, walking in a circle, increasing the circumference. The deepening darkness worked against them. Tracy stumbled several times on tree and plant roots. Lightning struck yet again, this time followed by a loud crack and the sound of splintering wood. She looked up in time to see a thin tree shear in two, the top half crashing through the canopy, dismembering limbs of nearby trees as it fell, and hitting the ground with enough force to send tremors through the soles of her feet. "This is idiotic," she said. It was something the old Tracy would have done, the Tracy who had no family and nothing to lose. She was also putting Pryor and her family at risk. It was time to leave. "Let's go back to the parking lot, let the storm pass, and we'll call for a canine unit." But this time Pryor was unwilling to give up. "Try calling the phone," she said. "Maybe we can hear it." It was a smart move. Tracy called the number. They stood very still, listening, trying to hear over the sound of the wind. "You hear anything?" Tracy asked. "Just the wind," Pryor said. The call went to voicemail. Tracy disconnected and tried again. Again, they could not hear the phone ringing. "Let's quickly drive a stake into the ground and mark the area with crime scene tape so we can find it if the phone dies or the app quits working," Tracy said. She snapped off a dry branch from a tree and used the knife from her go kit to sharpen one end. Pryor handed her a rock, and Tracy pounded the sharp end into the ground, then used the rock and the knife blade to split the top of the stick. She removed a roll of yellow crime scene tape from her bag and forced it into the cut, tying two streamers and giving the plastic a tug to ensure it was tight. When they retreated to the main trail, she'd tie crime scene tape around the trunk of several trees to guide their return, if she could find the main trail. In all her twisting and turning, she could not immediately recall the direction they'd walked. Do you remember the direction we came? She asked Pryor. Pryor looked around the area. Didn't we come from over there? She pointed toward the incline.
I think you're right, Tracy said.
They walked northeast, side by side, sweeping their flashlights left and right along the brush. Tracy was looking back over her shoulder to determine if she could see the two yellow streamers fluttering in the wind, when Pryor suddenly tugged on her arm, crying out. In the split second it took Tracy to turn back to the trail, Pryor was falling through the brush. Tracy grabbed Pryor's arm and dropped to the seat of her pants to keep Pryor from falling farther. Pryor had stepped through the brush into a hole, one much larger than a depression. Tracy held Pryor's arm as the young officer scrambled out. They fell back onto the brush, catching their breath.
Are you all right? Tracy asked.
Pryor nodded.
I think so.
She looked back to the hole.
How deep is it?
Tracy stood and helped Pryor to her feet. They took small, careful steps, testing the ground with their feet, seeking to determine the circumference of the hole, which was concealed by the foliage. It appeared to be approximately 4 feet in diameter. The foreboding feeling returned. Tracy dropped to her hands and knees at the edge of the hole. Pryor knelt beside her.
Hold back the plants, Tracy said.
Pryor pushed back the plants and Tracy directed a beam of light into the dark. The circumference of light centered on the broken body at the bottom of the pit, head contorted to the right, dark hair, splayed like the ribs of a fan, covering much of the young woman's face. They'd found Kavita Mukherjee. Foz stumbled off balance and hit the wall on the other side of the hallway. He'd managed to turn his head enough to see a person emerging from the adjacent apartment door just as 3 loud shots echoed in the hallway, along with 3 flashes of light. He rebounded off the wall, struggling to recover his balance. Andrea Gonzalez stood in front of him, her mouth opening and closing, speaking with urgency, though Foz couldn't hear her. The ringing in his right ear deadened all other sound, and it was as if he was watching a silent movie. Every movement passed as if through a thick, clear fluid. Gonzalez pushed him again, this time farther down the wall, away from the door and the possible line of fire, if additional shooters were inside the apartment. Her voice came back online.
All right? Are you all right?
She asked, over the sound of a woman screaming and a baby wailing, presumably from inside the apartment.
I'm all right. I'm all right, he heard himself say.
From the way Gonzalez winced, he deduced he was shouting. The body of a Hispanic man lay sprawled on the tile floor, blood saturating a white tank top and already running in rivulets along the cracks and seams. The man's jeans sagged low on his hips, revealing black underpants. Foz stepped forward to kick the gun away from his hand, but pulled back his foot when he didn't see a gun. What he saw instead was a cell phone near the man's right hand. He recognized the face from the DMV photo. Eduardo Felix Lopez. Gonzalez moved inside the apartment while Foz quickly handcuffed Lopez, as was procedure, and checked for a pulse, not finding one. He stood and followed Gonzalez inside the apartment. A woman sat slumped in the corner, clutching a wailing child to her chest. When Foz swept his gun right to left, briefly taking aim at the woman, she screamed again, something incomprehensible, and turned her head to the wall. Gonzalez entered from a room to the right, speaking to the woman in Spanish.
¿Hay alguien más aquí? ¿Hay alguien más aquí?
The woman lowered her head against the child. Foz continued forward, clearing the kitchen, then a bathroom. When he returned, Gonzalez knelt beside the woman and was pointing to the open door.
Dime tu nombre. Dime tu nombre.
Foz had a hard time hearing either of them with the child crying and the persistent ringing in his ears, and he couldn't understand what they were saying.
El hombre en el pasillo. ¿Cómo se llama?
Gonzalez said. When the woman did not answer, Gonzalez gripped the woman's shoulder and turned her.
¿Cómo se llama?
López, the woman shouted.
Se llama Eduardo López.
Gonzalez looked to Foz, then again to the woman.
¿Quién vive en el apartamento del lado?
The woman pointed out the door.
Eloiso, Eloiso.
Gonzalez stood, exhaled a held breath, and spoke to Foz.
Like I said,
You can prepare for just about anything and still get it wrong. She says Lopez lives next door, in 511, but came over just before we got here. Faz turned to the hallway, to Lopez's twisted body. The voice they'd heard speaking Spanish had been his, maybe on his cell phone. They'd just killed their only potential link to the Monique Rogers shooting. Worse, Gonzalez appeared to have shot an unarmed man. 26. Tracy stood beside her truck in the parking lot of the Bridal Trail State Park, waiting for what was certain to be a large contingent of police and forensic experts. Though the physical storm might have passed, the police storm was just starting, and jurisdiction would be the first battle. Though Kavita Mukherjee lived in Seattle, and Aditi Banerjee had filled out a missing persons report with the Seattle Police Department, Kavita's body had been found in Bellevue. Bellevue had its own police force and jurisdiction over the state park and crimes committed therein. Tracy's only conceivable basis for not surrendering jurisdiction was a lack of information. That is, it remained possible that Kavita had been murdered in Seattle and her body dumped in a Bellevue state park. That would be for the experts to decide. One thing was for certain. Tracy wasn't about to just give up the case, not until they knew, definitively, what had happened. Her captain, however, might think differently, which was why Tracy called in the location of the body to her sergeant, Billy Williams, and brought up the issue of jurisdiction, deciding to tackle that problem head-on. She told Williams she intended to work the crime scene, if in fact it was a crime scene, and asked that a team from the King County Medical Examiner's Office and from SPD's CSI unit be dispatched to preserve whatever evidence existed. They could debate jurisdiction later. Billy agreed, but said Tracy would have to fight that battle without him. Williams was on his way to South Park, along with an anticipated throng of brass and Stuart Funk, the King County Medical Examiner. Faz and Andrea Gonzalez had been involved in a shooting. After confirming that neither Faz nor Gonzalez had been shot, Tracy told Williams she would meet CSI officers and forensic personnel in the parking lot to give them the lay of the land before leading them to the body. After disconnecting, Tracy called Kelly Rosa's cell number. Rosa was a forensic anthropologist for the King County Medical Examiner's Office. She had exhumed Tracy's sister's remains from a burial site in Cedar Grove and was largely considered one of the best forensic examiners in the state, if not the country. Technically, they didn't need a forensic anthropologist. Rosa's skill was in the handling of skeletal remains and decomposed bodies, but Tracy trusted Rosa as much as she trusted Stuart Funk. She wanted someone who would tell her what evidence existed and give an opinion on what had happened. The last thing she wanted was somebody indecisive, somebody unwilling to say whether Mukherjee had been killed elsewhere and her body moved and dumped into the hole. Rosa would have no problem making that call, and likely others. Tracy also called Kaylee Wright. Wright worked out of the Special Operations Section of the King County Sheriff's Office as a tracker, or sign cutter. She'd hunted down the bodies Gary Ridgway had dumped during his decades-long murder spree, and she had helped Tracy solve a cold case in Klickitat County, in which the victim was a young woman who had been killed 40 years earlier. Wright had pieced together what had happened to the woman using photographs of footprints and tire tracks originally taken by a young officer who had found the body in a clearing in the woods. While Tracy waited in the parking lot for the forensic teams, Katie Pryor remained in the woods. Tracy had directed Pryor to establish a perimeter by stringing yellow crime scene tape around the trunks of trees, then to designate a path, other than the foot trail, to and from the grave. A designated path would hopefully preserve whatever evidence might exist on the foot trail and the larger trails connected to it. Footprints in the dirt, strands of hair or clothing snagged in branches and broken twigs and trampled leaves. Then again, multiple days of summer weather had no doubt enticed horseback riders, joggers, dog walkers, and berry pickers, who might have already trampled any evidence on the park's trails. But Tracy couldn't make that assumption. She needed Wright's expertise to tell her what was evidence and what wasn't. Kins was the first to arrive from his home in Madison Park, just across the 520 bridge. He parked his blue BMW beside Tracy's truck and got out of the car, shaking his head. "You're always right, aren't you?" he said. She gave that comment some thought. Then she said, I wish I wasn't. Not in this case. Sensing her mood, Kin said,
You all right?